Okay, so tell the police to come in, and because I want to explain something at the start that I think is important. We're dealing here with an era that runs life that I don't believe anyone else has gone into. And I want to explain how they got involved. I want to thank you all for coming out. As I mentioned before, and I've said to me, 8:30 at night in this cold, not because I couldn't shiver. I said, all right, but I'm only here limited days. Maybe there are some people who will want to take advantage. So I greatly appreciate it. What happened was as follows. When I came in on the end of 69, I saw right away I would never make a living in this world, of course. Anyone who's salaried, anyone who's honest, at least at that time, could not make a living. And I don't have to tell you, until today, I've yet to have the repairs done on my house, and I should ask for a receipt and get a receipt. At the most, they'll tell me, yeah, we'll send it to you in the mail. I guess they mail it to China, not Israel. So when I saw, I'm a Rebbe, I'm a teacher, I'm on the books. I taught all the years, I taught for the Israeli government, which was Michalba, the Jewish Agency, Mahon Goldberg, BMT, and of course Yeshiva University, which tries to avoid scandals. I don't say they always avoid them, but they try to avoid scandals. So I said, look, I'm a young man, I won't make a living in my life, but at least I'm going to have the ability to learn so much that others will never be able to. And one of the things I did, the old Yekkes who survived the war, all of them, almost without exception, retired and wound up in the greater Rehavia area. As you all know, Rehavia is famous, they walked the streets like today, all you hear is English and French. When I went around the Aliyah, I heard a lot of German. So I made it my business to get hold of anyone who was a graduate or studied at the Hildesheim Rabbinic Seminary, and I'd make an appointment, go see them, and drill them about the Rav. Later, I uncover a doctor, Dr. Werner Zulestein, who he dies at about 102, and his girlfriend, after his wife died, had a wonderful marriage, they had no children. His girlfriend, who would go with him to lectures, to my lectures, other lectures, was the mother of my students. Was the mother, yes. Her daughter studied with me, and her son-in-law studied with me. So I had protexia. And he was fabulous. He wrote a memoir. I got a copy. It was a family memoir. His nephews and nieces published it. I got a copy for Rabbi Lamb. From all over the world, when I published the Rav, I quote from the memoir, everyone bothered me. Where did you get it? Because the Rav actually was a guest. He describes in the memoir how his wife asked the Rav, where are you going to be for Seder? And the Rav said, I don't know. I had just come to Berlin. She said, I'd like you to come to us. So the Rav said, well, could I see the way you kasher the house? So he came. And he writes in the memoir, he walked out and my wife felt maybe she was doing something wrong and he came back with a big bouquet of flowers. So I uncovered people who knew the Rav. Now, this period was of tremendous interest to me for another reason too. The Rav exposed there, we're going to talk in a moment about the Wissenschaft der Studentum, scientific Jewish knowledge. And that topic is of great interest to me. I went to Bernard Rebel Graduate School. I have two masters. I have a doctorate. And I know a little bit about scientific Jewish knowledge. And I don't know if you know what's going on in Yeshiva University today, but the students who feed into me in the Kollel, those who understand me well will admit to me I'm the first time they ever had a Rebbe who doesn't start cursing and falling at the mouth when the Rebbe mentions Chachmat Yisrael, scientific Jewish knowledge, scholarship, or Wissenschaft der Studentum, whatever language you know about. So here we're talking about 1926. The Rav comes to Berlin. He was there about 6.5 years. He referred to these years as the 7 good years of his life. It was a dramatic step for him. I don't have to tell you, a son of Vaychik, a grandson of the Brisker Rav. If any of you have learned in Lakewood, I understand Jerry Shaskis has a brother who is a Lakewood graduate. I can assure you that when Jerry tells you the Rav went to Berlin in 1926, he says it so proudly, he discovered the big world, he stepped out of the ghetto. His brother would say, and the Rav made the greatest mistake of the century. What a mistake, what a tragedy. He went to Berlin, polluted his mind. All right, this is, I've been through it, Jerry. Believe me, I learned in Lakewood, I learned at NYU, I knew Baron Cutler, very close. I know the Rav, Baruch Hashem. All right, it's a very big move. The Rav said to his own children, and I heard this from Tova, I heard it from Tara, I heard it from Professor Yitzchak Tversky, I heard it from Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein. They all said, the Rebbe would say time and again, you youngsters, you're so lucky. You don't know how hard it was, for me to go from a world of brisk and chassidus, go to Berlin, go to university, and you do it so naturally. It comes so easy for you. So the Rebbe goes to Berlin. Goes to the University of Berlin, and at the University of Berlin, he studies mathematics, he studies physics, he winds up in philosophy. But all his life, when he gave lectures outside of the classroom, we'll see in a few minutes, he was entirely brisk. If you studied with the Rebbe and only moved in the classroom, you saw a brilliant man, but you had no concept of how much knowledge he had. When you get involved with his philosophical lectures, you read some of the essays that he published during his lifetime, like Isha Halakha, you see the mathematics and the physics and the knowledge of general philosophy, the halachic mind, not just the halachic man. These are two classic works that have been published. Knowledge of literature, a fabulous amount of knowledge. But this all came easy. Something was happening in Berlin that was a much greater challenge to him. And then we have to come to the rebirth of German Orthodoxy. Rav Hirsch started it, but Rav Hirsch never went beyond the high school. In other words, he organized an elementary school, he organized what's called the Beit Sefer Reali, a gymnasium. He never went beyond the high school. A generation later, Rabbi Dr. Azriel Hildesheimer organized the rabbinical seminary in Berlin called the Berlin Rabbinical Seminary for Orthodox Judaism, popularly called Hildesheimers. When I was growing up, they called Jewish Theological Seminary Schechters. In my youth, all I heard was Schechters. I had no idea Schechters. They slaughtered you there, you understand? Because Solomon Schechter was the guiding spirit, so they called it Schechters. Now, what was Hildesheimer? And Hildesheimer was very different. I said a rabbinical seminary. Tell me, do you have a rabbinical seminary in London?
No, not anymore.
You had Jews College. With all due respect, Jewish College never achieved. It was all right. Chile's father's a graduate. I don't want to say anything negative.
Not
a graduate of Jewish College? Okay. But the Jewish College, yeah. Jewish College is Jewish College. But it's a seminary. You don't have a seminary. Do we have a rabbinical seminary in Israel? In America? No, we don't have it. What's the difference? I went to a yeshiva. I teach in a yeshiva. What is the difference? See, a rabbinical seminary is a product of the Western world. What characterizes the Western world? We're pragmatic, we're utilitarian. It's Mishnah Shtetl here. A yeshiva, you come in, what are you going to leave? Mezitz, Malerin, Benvarim, the Bankel, you warm the bench. You go to Lakewood, in Lakewood there's the famous story, which I can tell you is true. In Lakewood, Friday afternoon, there are no classes. Fine. The base medrash is empty. Traditionally, you go for a walk, you get ready for Shabbos, you go shopping. So Friday afternoon, some Lakewood guy from the Kollel goes through a red light. this must be the late 80s. The policeman stops him, and he's writing a ticket. Is that the word you use here, a ticket? Okay. And the policeman says to him, tell me, how long are you learning in the yeshiva? So the kid says, 10 years. So the policeman says to him, 10 years and you haven't graduated? No wonder you went to a red light. You're a stupid kid. Okay? No, a seminary had a set program. Not only that, what do we learn in the yeshiva? You go into yeshiva, I started learning Gemara at the age, in fifth grade. I don't know how old was I, 9 years old, let's say. Started learning Gemara. Went on to Yeshiva University, Yeshiva, you know, Talmudical Academy High School, it's feeder school. All I learned was Gemara. In college, all I learned was Gemara. For Smicha, 90% of my studies was basically rabbinic literature, Gemara, and Yom Hadea, a little bit of Chaim. But that's all you learn. All right, they expect you to do the rest on your own. A seminary is much more pragmatic. 2 hours a day Gemara, an hour Jewish philosophy, elocution lessons, how to speak. We were just talking before about a student of mine who Johnny knows, he can't speak to save his life. He speaks the way he writes. He'll quote a book, give you the date it was published, the exact pages. By that time, the audience has forgotten what he's doing and who he's quoting. But elocution lessons, Jewish history. So you see, a seminary was a seminary, but all this is minor. There was a tremendous difference between the yeshiva world and the seminary of Rabbi Hilda's Heimat. You know the difference? A yeshiva functions in a traditional fashion. I'll give you an example in 1 minute. A seminary is scientific. Wissenschaft des Judentum, Chochmat Yisrael. Where did this begin? When the Jews came out of the ghetto, so they were blinded. In other words, regardless of what your daughters are taught in Beis Yaakov, Mendelssohn, who was the great-grandson of Reb Moshe Isserles, the Rama for whom he was named, Reb Moshe Mendelssohn, great-grandfather, Reb Moshe Isserles, the Rama, who gave us the Shulchan Aruch that we use, he remained religious. He remained religious, 100%. We have letters that he was writing that have survived where he writes, I must break off now because the Shabbat is approaching. There was a famous German writer, philosopher, Lessing, he writes to Lessing, you can visit me when you're in Berlin because I cannot travel on the Sabbath. He remained religious. But his kids were blinded. 4 out of the 8 converted, or 3 out of the 6 that survived. 50% of his children survived, didn't die young. Half of them converted away from Judaism. There was not one great-grandson who was Jewish. The first cultural ambassador to the State of Israel, when we established relations with Germany and accepted reparations, was a person named Henzel. And the Israeli cultural liaison, Castle, who was had a great knowledge of names, and matters like this, he was a librarian, essentially. He said to him, are you a great-great-grandson? He said, yes. Henzel was from Mendelssohn. The next generation wasn't so blinded. In other words, this is the good life blinded. It's like I once saw an Israeli, I remember in 78, some Israeli left the country and he wound up in Kew Gardens Hills. And I was there that summer teaching for the Jewish agency, trying to encourage the young people to come in Aliyah and to make shidduchim. I ran classes, and the idea behind them was that any boy or any man or woman coming is interested in Aliyah. It was called Chevet Aliyah Torah. It's one of my good ideas over a lifetime. It functioned for quite a few years. CAT, anyone remember the name? That was the acronym. Chevrat Aliyah Toranit. So I saw this Israeli comes to Kew Gardens Hills, and every day he's buying something, a television, a second television, a masterful, you know, he's going crazy with joy. Everything was so cheap in America at that time compared to Israel. Things have changed. But I could understand he was blinded by the beauty of America. Everything is available. These people on the next generation were no longer so blinded. But what did develop? Reform Judaism, 1818, Hamburg, the first Reform temple. At the same time, Leopold Sunz started viewing Jewish texts, subjects, in a scientific fashion. The world now has science, the world has changed, the world has developed. We are much more scientific. We understand things from a scientific point of view. If we can do mathematics, chemistry, history scientifically, why can't we view the Torah and all that goes with it scientifically? And a movement began called Wissenschaftliches Judentum, scientific Jewish scholarship. Now, what do I mean? Let me give you a simple example that everyone will understand in 1 minute what I'm talking about. You open up a Gemara. You have a Daf Yomi here, right? You learn Gemara. Tell me, when you open the Gemara, do you start to question the text in front of you? How do you know you have the right text? This Gemara has been copied how many times? Today, it's no big deal. You photograph, you print, you have a computer, fine. But 1,000 years ago, 800 years ago, till type was invented, 500, 600 years ago, everything was copied by hand. Tell me, I'm going to write a letter here, okay? What if I'm writing to? I'm writing to Netanyahu. Dear Mr. Netanyahu, we want to compliment you for your great courage in allowing building to go on in the holy city, which is ours and ours alone. We are your admirers sincerely. Chili copies it. You copy from Chili. By the time it gets all the way around the room, Jerry copies it. Now let's compare and see how many mistakes went from my letter to the time you copied it. No? Now let's talk about the Gemara. How many times was it copied? How do you know you have the proper text? How do you know there aren't varying readings? It's a fascinating topic. Right or wrong? Open up a Gemara and start thinking about all the possibilities that could have happened. Now, we certainly don't pay attention to that on the initial level of learning. Enough learning Gemara, we have to learn, we have to understand, this is the Gemara we have, this is the Gemara my father learned with, this is the Gemara my grandfather learned with. In a scientific fashion, they begin to research the Gemara. You go to the Hebrew University, today you log in to their manuscript department, you check how many different manuscripts there are in the world on this Gemara. We have people in Jerusalem who work on this for 50 years to edit the Gemara. Look at the Frankel edition of the Rambam, which was completed just about 2 years ago. This was a massive undertaking in B'nai Brak, sponsored by a Holocaust survivor who made money in America. I'm not happy about one aspect. There is a terrible aspect to it, that in back of every Rambam, they index all that has been written on Maimonides, and they made a decision to leave out one of the greatest Jews of the 20th century, Rav Avraham Yitzchak HaKohen Kuk. So are you aware of that? I have great reservations, but I learned, what can I tell you, it's the most beautiful, easiest Rambam to learn with, but you check the variant readings on the Rambam, you can find 10, 20, 30 variant readings in every chapter. So that's what we mean by scientific Jewish scholarship. Now, most Rosh Yeshiva today, with the swing to the right, are certainly opposed. They hear scientific Jewish scholarship. They think immediately of Jewish Theological Seminary, of people who taught there. It's not a terrible thing. It can be very good and very positive, very constructive. But I'm the first one to agree, you don't expose a high school kid or a college kid to scientific. First, let him master Shas and Paiskim. When he masters Shas and Paiskim, if he's interested and has this inclination to go into scientific Jewish scholarship, I'll be the last person in the world to discourage him. You all benefit from scientific Jewish scholarship. Tell me, do you open up a Ramban occasionally? What am I talking about? When I had a study Ramban, we mimkitsitit, we shook. We had a Ramban in no periods and no exclamation points and no explanations and who knew what text we had. Today you have edited editions of the Ramban. You have two major edited editions of Rashi. One that was done in Hildesheimer, Professor Berliner, and one that was done in America, Rabbi Chevelle, who stood on the shoulders of Berliner and went further. So we benefit today from scientific Jewish scholarship. In Israel, thousands of Talmidei Chachamim make a living out of editing Rishonim, the Ramban, the Rashba, the Ritva, the Meiri. What we have coming out, I tell my students, I was born before my time. Today, everything is edited. So now the Rav comes to Berlin, and he is exposed to scientific Jewish scholarship. As a matter of fact, I have a long footnote in my biograph of my monograph biography of the Rav, the introduction in volume one. I have a long footnote. I actually uncovered from living people at that time, Eidut Nimana, that the Rav audited classes at Hildesheimer. I spoke with Dr. Borg, among others, and I'll tell you a little story about Dr. Borg. If you want to know what a mind, you know what I'm talking about, Rabbi Dr. Joseph Borg? Well, the Mizrahi leader, the father, his son, I don't think turned out so well, but he had a daughter, Zichrono Livracha, who was a tzaddiket, and when the son he lost. So Dr. Borg, I once was at Heichal Shlomo, I forget what the event was many years ago. There were about 10 people standing around him. He turns to each person, speaks to this one in German, the next one in French, the next one in Spanish, this one in Yiddish, looks at me, speaks to me in English. This is all within one little discussion. I don't think he used Hebrew once. When I wanted to discuss this with him, I call him, I say, Dr. Borg, Po medaber Aharon Rakefet. In English, he answers me, you're not Aharon Rakefet, you're Aharon Rothkopf, you wrote the work on Rabbi Revel. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. Anyway, Eidut Nimana, that's the Rav, audited. You know what the word audit means? I'm using the word audited. Not everyone knows in this sense. It means to, not to be a formal student, but to attend classes. The Rav didn't need credit. He sat in on classes. Not only that, the greatest personality at Hildesheimer's at that time was Rabbi Dr. Yechiel Yaakov Weinberg. I don't have to, we've already mentioned him. I spoke about him to the high school group that time after Shabbos morning. He was a Lithuanian, a Gaon Adia. He wound up in Berlin. The story of why he wound up in Berlin is fascinating. To tell it to you in a nutshell, he was a Slobodka yeshiva boy. His mind sought Western culture. The Rashi Yeshiva and the Mashkiach of Slobodka, the Alter, but Nassim Zvi Finkel, Zeichel Tzedakah Livracha, were worried he's going to go off the path. So they married him off to a girl from a small town, and with the girl came the shtetl, Pilsudski. He got the rabbinate there. The marriage didn't work. It was whatever the reasons why. His talmidim, it's interesting, they told me their take on it. And it was not her fault. She was a simple lady, and this guy was a gaon, and whenever you deal with gaonim, if they're not totally normal. This is part of being a gaon. You have to accept it. Gaon, she gaon. When we learn from the Rav, you all heard the Rav of Terah. Why did we put up with it? Because we knew he's a golem, you have to put up with it. That's it. That's part of the price you pay with dealing with these people. His marriage didn't work. He got divorced. Then he ran away to Berlin. Ran away to Berlin. He got stuck. World War I broke out. Became rabbi of a little base medrash in Berlin. And decided to get himself education. And he went on to become director of Hildesheim. He was a Yid, a Talmud Chacham. This was a Litvish Gaon who had broadened and mastered scientific Jewish scholarship. I had the privilege and have the privilege not only of engendering the classic work on him. This is my Talmud, Mark Shapiro, writes me, who did a doctorate at Harvard on Rabbi Dr. Yehiel Yaakov Weinberg, the last doctorate done under Professor Tweskin's authority before he died, unfortunately. And he writes in the introduction, I first heard about Rabbi Dr. Yehiel Yaakov Weinberg from my Rebbe and BMT, Rabbi Aaron Rekefer, but that's a small part of that, the biggest part. My first student, the Michlala, in 1971, Yonah Levy, I had this Israeli girl, she wore a shas every Mishnah could rattle off. She later marries the son of the Talmud Muvhak of Rabbi Yonak of pre-World War II. After World War II, he had nowhere to go. He had no family. They took him in. The Weingott family took him in. Avram Abba Weingott was his Talmud Muvhak after World War II, marries Yonah Levy, and we are best of friends. So I remember I reached him at a wedding. I had to confirm something. I was calling him, took the call immediately. And he said, Rabbi Chiya von Yaakov Weinberg told me, "Es given by me a Talmud, aber ich kenne ich dem Rufin a Talmud." He did come into my classes, but I can't call him a Talmud. Why did Rabbi Chiya Yaakov say that? What did he mean by that? And this is the fascinating part. The Rav was exposed to scientific Jewish scholarship, but he did not go in that path. It's a conscious decision. Here he is in Berlin at university, occasionally auditing classes, particularly in 26 and 27 at Hildesheim, but he remained with Brisk. He never got involved in the scientific method. You could study with the Rav for 18 years, as Rabbi Michal Shurkin did. Never once did he start questioning the variant readings, bringing the Dikduke Sofrim of Rabbi Rabinovich. There's a classic volume of 120 years ago where a great Lithuanian Gaon tried to put together all the variant readings. The Rav. Yeah, I just called it. Just said the right. I just said the case of Frimmer right a second ago, right? You heard it or you didn't hear it? The tape, we have it on the tape. The case of Frimmer, absolutely. The Rav never got involved. What's fascinating, but respect he had. How do we know he had respect? That happened to me. Watch. We're in the middle of class. And there's a knock on the door. There really, no one interrupted the Rav. You stood in awe, you were frightened, interrupt the Rav. Mr. Abrams, that was the administrator of the yeshiva, who Jerry remembers well. We used to call him the Jap, because he was very short, but everyone was frightened of him. He ran a tight operation. So the Jap comes in, and he says to the Rav, Soloveitchik, a special messenger just came from Israel and delivered these books for you. You know what the books were? It was one of the classic works in Chochmat Yisrael, the Balei Tosfot of Rabbi Ephraim Elimelech Orbach. You've heard the name Professor Orbach, later at Hebrew U, the ranking professor of Chochmat Yisrael. We saw the Rav take, it was at that time one volume, later it comes out in two volumes in a revised edition. Many years later, I knew Professor Orbach, he lived around the corner from me. And the Rav, I could see, he looks at it, glances, but I could see there was Derech Eretz in his eyes. Then he went back to the Shia. Never adopted. His uncle, he had a very famous uncle, Rabbi Nachman Karakovsky, was Vilna Magid. His uncle, who was married to his mother's sister. His father was married to Pesha Feinstein. The uncle was married to Badara Feinstein. Hashem Yikom Damom, she did not survive the Holocaust. The uncle wrote a work on the Rambam, Avodat HaMelech. The first part was published. The rest was lost in World War II. In that work, he quotes his nephew on variant readings in Maimonides. And that led me to believe that the Rebbe was exposed to it. He was aware of it. He knew how to handle it. But he didn't go that path. More than that, the last time I saw the Rebbe live was January 1983. And he was aged and ill. And I went back with him to his apartment that day. And his mind was good. I spoke with him about many questions. Sometimes you'll see footnotes what I discussed with the Rebbe that day. And one of the questions I asked him, Rebbe, your uncle quotes you four times, Avodat HaMelech. And the Rebbe says to me, four times, six times. So when I got back to Israel, you have to know how to use Talmidim. You have Talmidim, certain Talmidim, if you want to go to a Yankee, a baseball game. So certain Talmidim can fill you in when it's best to go. If you want to go to a Broadway show, you have to ask different Talmidim. You have to know who's who. If you want to know what to buy in Borough Park, that's a third type of Talmud. But this Talmud I have is a walking encyclopedia. Never also a gong, never got married. See, the minute someone never gets married already, it's a sign of a shigong. Because what does it mean, never getting married? No woman is good enough. You're such a perfectionist, no woman is smart enough, pretty enough, capable enough, idiot. You're a human being. But all right, Azegedas. He never got married this time. So I said to him, Yossi, this is many years ago, I said, Yossi, I found four times the Rebbe's quoted. The Rebbe says his uncle quotes him six times. Do me a favor, take a look at the Avodat HaMelech and give me the final figure. He comes back a week later, eight times, Rebbe. And he gives me the original times, and you'll see I have a footnote in my work on the Rebbe. Now, question is, why didn't the Rav go the path of Chochmat Yisrael? Why did he remain so totally committed to Brisk, to Eastern Europe? What happened? What was the key factor there? And here I believe, and I'm putting together a puzzle, but I think I have it. I think I have it right, and you can understand the Rebbe made certain comments over the decades. It all fits together like a glove and a hand. Now, what was the key factor? The key factor was one little East European Jew who resided in Berlin. His name was Reb Chaim Heller. Make believe you know who Reb Chaim Heller is, so the ignorant pass for the wise. Reb Chaim Heller was a gone idea, the man who everything. It's a short little man. I knew Reb Chaim Heller. Not only did he know everything, he knew all biblical criticism. He knew secular knowledge. He knew ancient Greek, Latin, Semitics, Assyrian. It was beyond belief what one mind could carry. But Reb Chaim Heller, with all that he did, and he engaged in Chochmat Yisrael, he published an edited edition of Maimonides' Sefer HaMitzvot. When the Rav would ask a Talmud, in my days, Talmidim would miss half the shiur, because every time he needed a Sefer, he kicked the kid up to the library, which was one floor above, until they found the Sefer to bring it down. Today, I don't know about other rebbeim, but those of you listening to my shiur know I don't skip a beat because everything is Xeroxed in front of me. In other words, I come to shiur, it's Xeroxed, it's ready. I don't want to waste time sending a Yindel to find your cipher in the base medrash till he finds it. I'll lose to the 10 minutes. So the rabbi, I can still remember, the kid comes down with a regular sefer mitzvah. The rabbi says, "Nay, nishtas is ruled from Reb Chaim Chela. I want the edited edition of Reb Chaim Chela." He was a genius, but he remained essentially a litvak, an East European. He couldn't leave his youth, and the rabbi was greatly influenced by Reb Chaim Chela. He became his father figure. Tobel Lichtenstein said, that's the word you have to use, it was his father's figure. He was in Berlin, he was lonely, there's no father there, there's no mother there, he's alone in the world, but Reb Chaim Chela is the person he turned to. His love, his respect for Chaim Chela was legendary. Jerry, do you remember the yard sign shiur? 3,000 people all around the world, and Reb Chaim Chela would walk in and the Reb would stop the shiur, go off the podium, go over to this little man, take his coat, bring him up on top. All the Rosh Yeshiva sat up front, Eibunun. How do you say that in English? I don't know, but you get the idea. And he would take Reb Chaim and sit him down. What derech eretz. Reb Chaim was saved from Hitler, came to America in the late 30s. He had no parnassah. What's he going to do in America? How many people could understand Reb Chaim? It was a genius of geniuses. Do you know what the Rav did? And the family would not let me publish this. You deal with the Soloveitchik, you're dealing with Goyim, so you have to pay the price. The family, but these are facts, what I'm telling you. The Rav raised money, gave the money to Yeshiva University, and Yeshiva University paid Rav Chaim Chela a monthly salary. In return for that salary, Reb Chaim Chela gave a few lectures in Bernard Rebbe Graduate School. You know how the lectures were given? Reb Chaim Chela would be sitting where I'm sitting. The Rav would be, he was a young man then, would be standing next to him, towering over him. Reb Chaim would talk, mumble on. The Rav would stop him. Let's say Reb Chaim spoke 4 minutes. The Rav now would explain what Reb Chaim said. It took 25 minutes. And then Reb Chaim would continue. And I had the schut. Reb Chaim Keller's grandson was my classmate, Izzy Perlmutter. Ah, so you know Izzy too. He's the big psychologist in Jerusalem. My daughter deals with him all the time because he always appears in the rabbinic court testifying. He's a great guy. He's had a hard life, but a great guy. I made the shirt for his son. You should know, Chaim Perlmutter.
He lived across the street from me.
Ah, so Chaim Perlmutter's beautiful marriage, give Amarek Kefet the credit. It's a story unto itself. So I'm standing, we were high school kids. If you know Yeshiva University, Amsterdam Avenue, I'm standing with Izzy playing ball in front of the yeshiva. The Rav comes over to us and he says, Yisrael, I said to the likes, and your grandfather wants to see you. I don't know what grandfather or the Rav. And he takes Yisrael by the hand to Bernard Rebbe Graduate School. He goes a half block away, brings him into the Zayda. That was the relationship. And that's the secret of the Hesper. And I come to a high point. I hope you follow through if you haven't already. If you want to become a good Jew, there are two Hesperim the Rav gave that are unsurpassed. He never equaled that level. I don't believe anyone in the 20th century came anywhere near the Rav. One Hesper was for the Brisker Rav, his uncle. It is the most fabulous analysis of what Brisk is about. Rabbi Aaron Lichtenstein considers that the Rav's high point of philosophy, theology, homiletics, unbelievable piece. It's called, do you know the name of that Hesped? Madodi Medodech. It's based upon Shirashirim. Why was my uncle, why is it, and Shirashirim is talking about the love affair, why is my beloved so different than everyone other one's boyfriend? But the Rav paraphrased it, why is my uncle, he took it literally, not figuratively, what is the difference between my uncle and your uncle? On this issue, I, a little kid from the Bronx named Ami Rothkopf once upon a time, begs to differ with Rabbi Lichtenstein. The Hesped on Reb Velvel is fabulous, but it's limited to Brisk. The Hesped on Reb Chaim Hella is the key to Torah Judaism. They were given a few months apart. And that Hesped goes down under the title Al Pleitat Sofreihem, the remnant of the scribes, the remnant from the previous generation. And that tells you who Reb Chaim was and what he was to the Rav and why the Rav gained so much from him. Let me just go one step further on this point. I'll take questions at the end because it's already quite, I want to finish by 9:30. Wait, we began 8:30. All right, so I can have more time. Good, beautiful. Don't rush. I want to make one more point. You can't win. In the long run, you cannot win. The Rav had a Talmud. Let's see if you know this, Jerry. Now I'm going to see a little before your time. Do you remember Rav Meir Simcha Feldblum?
He was my first year high school teacher.
First year high
school.
On Sanhedrin.
On Sanhedrin.
This Reb Meir Simcha Feldblum was a survivor. Went through the forest. People who went with him told me, his Gevena Kelsi Yeshiva Bacha, a genius. People said to me that we followed him in the forest because we knew he will survive. Survived, came to Yeshiva. The Rav loved him. Was a Rebbe like I was a Rebbe. I also began as a Rebbe. I had two rabbis last summer together. They had come to hear me speak. One was my student in 1962. He's a world famous rabbi today. And the other one was my student 2008-2009. So I said to these two rabbis, introduced them to each other. I said, I'll tell you the difference. Rabbi Flaum, I was your first Rebbe. Put you on your feet. I made a mention of you. Set you on the path. Rebbe, absolutely. Taught you a great deal. Molded your life. Absolutely. You see, Rabbi Katz, I get him not when he's 14, 15. When he's 25, 26. I had no influence on him. He influenced me. It's a different ballpark today. So Rabbi Katz, no, Rebbe, no, come on, let's be honest. At your age, what influence? Your wife had influence, not me. Rebbe Meir Simcha Feldblum was Jerry's first Rebbe. Your first Rebbe is your most important Rebbe. He puts you on the path. He was a Talmud Chacham, Rei Shemayim. Over the years, he went to Bernard Rebbe graduate school. That's part of the yeshiva that functions in a supposed scientific fashion. I went there, all right, I got involved in Jewish history. No one can be upset about that. He got involved in scientific Talmudic studies. And a few years later, he no longer was a Rebbe in the yeshiva, he was a professor in Bernard Rebbe Graduate School. And the Rav cried, and I quote, in Chagmeira as Professor Weiss, Hatsugachat my Meir Simcha. I'm afraid that the famous professor and Bernard Rebbe graduate who had been in Warsaw before, Professor Avraham Weiss, robbed my student at Meir Simcha and turned him into a scientific scholar, which he later became a great scholar and later goes on to Bar Ilan University. Unfortunately, he's no longer alive. No, the Rav had one son. My classmate, Rabbi Dr. Professor Chaim Soloveitchik. My age, he was born Sukkot, I was born Hanukkah. So we're a few months. months, I'm a few months younger than Chaim. Can anyone tell me who Chaim is? Chaim just published his magnum opus, Yayin Bimei HaBeinayim, Wine During the Medieval Period. I told Chaim, in my humble opinion, he's gone way beyond his professor, the famous Jacob Katz, whose classic work is Goyshel Shabbat, a Hildesheimer graduate, by the way, and Goyshel Shabbat. He shows the interaction of economic, social factors on the halakha. A goy shel Shabbat. No, what do you do here in the shul? I saw when I came Shabbos, I have a goy. In Israel, we have a problem. We have to live without goyim. It's not so simple. Thank God we have Philippines now with all the old people. People are living longer. So on Shabbat, if you need a goy, you run. We had already where people ran to find where the Filipino is. All right. A classic work. Chaim's work on wine? I've never seen anything like it. Salavetchik had all of Masechet Avodah Zarah worked out. And the scientific scholarship on top of it, it's overwhelming that one person can be so brilliant. No, this is the Rav son. So I went over to my good friend, Professor Abraham Grossman, who's one of the giants at Hebrew U. We davened together 41 years. He wrote on a scientific scholarship on Rashi, on Rabbeinu Gershom, right or wrong, Professor Grossman. I said, Avraham, tell me, if we could show Heimke's work to the Rav, what would he say? It's a good piece of work or a nourishment? And I gotta tell you, Professor Grossman said, from what I know about the Rav, he would say it's a Narishkeit. So you see, you can't win them all. He ran away from Chochmat Yisrael, and Chaim, on the other hand, what genius, what a piece of work. And I have to say, when I complimented Chaim, you know, Chaim, again, he's not married, was a little bit hesitant. How will he react? I was happy, I have to tell you. He embraced me, Ani, I'm humbled. Thank you for your kind words. I told him, if there are 10 people in the world, I told him what a student told me. I have a very dear student, a very important doctor in New York at Columbia Presbyterian, head of a department. You may know Columbia is what's the top hospital in the New York City area, General Hospital, Columbia Presbyterian, Washington Heights, not far from the yeshiva. So when I told Shragai, I just made a see him in Yayin Bimei HaBeinayim. He said, Rebbe, you're one of 10 people in the world who can understand it. And there is some truth to it, because you have to have a very deep background in both Shas and Paiskim and Chochmat Yisrael. And I told Chaim what my Talmud said, but I said, at least I feel I'm one of the 10. I understood it, then I appreciate it. But that's Chochmat Yisrael. See, that's one part of the Berlin experience. But there was more. There was more. And this I alluded to on Shabbos. Did I speak here Shabbos?
Yes. No,
on Sunday. Not on Shabbos. Yesterday. Sunday. I go to Mizrahi, right?
Yes,
okay. You see, what the Rav Sharon Berlin and what attracted him and the Yekkers, their Derech Eretz, their deportment, this culture, and it reflects in every aspect of their life. And in Berlin, he saw an Agudat Yisrael that was no longer the Gatzerissen of Bekeshev. They didn't go around wearing ripped clothes. These were people who, when they set a table, as I believe I mentioned, there were three forks on the table. You had to know, one for the entree, one for the main course, and one for the cake. And he was attracted, and he became a member of Agudat Yisrael. But I have to tell you, there was another side to the coin that I didn't speak about Sunday that's very, very revealing. These are distant Germany, and the whole Hirschian crowd to a certain degree at that time, they were so at home in German culture that they felt, as much as they were Jews, they were proud to be Germans. And the Rav told us a story, and I heard this from him, he repeated it time and again. It's just a shame he didn't mention the name of the rabbi. And he describes a German rabbi whom he says was medatek in mitzvot and very careful in his commitment to Yiddishkeit. And he once had a discussion with this rabbi. And the rabbi says to him, I have nothing in common with the Jewish masses in Eastern Europe. They are primitive. And he says, the Rav, listen to this call, says, Efsha, maybe I have something in common with the Chaim Moshe Bishinsky. It's a big Talmud Chacham. But outside of that, I have nothing in common with the masses. And this left an impression on the Rav. It is my contention that years later, when the Rav faced this tremendous quandary, whether the Jews, the Holocaust, Palestine, the nascent state of Israel, or the tremendous movement that was a precursor to the establishment of Israel, I think that statement also helped push him over the cliff into the Mizrahi camp. Because there's such a difference between Mizrahi and Aguda on that issue. To a certain degree, it continues until today. It certainly was true in Germany. The German Jew was so integrated, so cultured, and so much part of the German society that he looked down upon the East Europeans. What do I have in common with these primitives? And even today, in a different sense, because the Aguda is more ghettoized, in the state of Israel, if you understand the inner workings of the communities, you do not see Agudat Yisrael reaching out beyond their boundaries. You just don't see. Chabad, yes, but Chabad is not a good at Israel. The Mizrahi element, and I use the word in a popular sense because there is no more Mizrahi today. It's an organization that succeeded so it put itself out of business. Because the average Israeli child today, you see kippah all over Israel. You see women with tichels all over Israel. You see television reporters. We're talking about Reshet Aleph, Reshet Bet, top people, economic reporter, health reporter, someone doing on foreign policy, and you see all over the place a woman with a tichel, a woman with a shekel, a man with a kippah. No one says boom. The average kid today, my grandchildren don't even understand why we need a party. What do we need a party for? We're part and parcel of the country. But you'll see the Mizrahi attitude is constantly to push out of the ghetto, constantly to reach out. People go to Tel Aviv to make Shabbos in Dizengoff. Rabbi Alon, once a year, takes a whole group of yeshiva boys Shabbos in Dizengoff. There was an organization formed called Rosh Barosh that is quite successful right in the heart of Dizengoff. So there is, because of a different type of understanding, there is that feeling that I can still sense today that Aguda or people of that ilk withdraw more. And the Mizrahi that is not frightened by secularism in the Western world and general culture, they're out more. And that feeling of brotherhood. I know when I worked for the branch of the Mossad, Matiev, in Russia, this our branch of the Mossad began with a kibbutznik from Kibbutz Sa'ad. He was the one, Aryeh Kroll, who went to Ben Gurion after he had visited his sisters in Russia, who survived the Holocaust, and the kibbutz sent him, and he's the one who went to Aryeh Kroll and got this whole branch set up, and that whole outreach, and not looking religious, irreligious, but you're a Jew, we have to do something. And it's a different approach. It could be I'm not entirely correct, but there is some truth to it. And the Rav says this in Berlin, and there's no question that this experience later comes to the fore when he has to deal with Mizrahi Agudah. Finally, let me conclude, and then a word of Torah. There was something else about Berlin that saved him and saved us. When he went to Berlin, his father was very upset. So his father only agreed if an older Talmud of his father by the name of Genachovsky, Moshe Chaim Genachovsky, would go along with the Rav. He was also going to Berlin, and the Rav and Genachovsky roomed together, and Rav Moshe Soloveitchik felt that Genachovsky would take care of the Rav. One day, someone came to Genachovsky, who was older than the Rav. He already was late 20s, and said to him, "I have a shidduch for you. I want you to take out this girl." So Genachovsky responded, "I'm happy to take the girl out, but I feel a little awkward because I have a roommate." So the person who was proposing the shidduch to Genachovsky said to him, "I have a girl for your roommate as well. These two girls room together, East European, seeking education in Germany." That girl, whom the Rav took out, was Tanya Levitt. The rest was history. She becomes Rebbetzin Tanya, and she becomes the Rav's soulmate. You saw it in the documentary, and I think the documentary was fabulous on the relationship between the Rav and Tanya. Those of us who knew the Rebbetzin personally can testify that this was so, and as I told you, when he started Yada Loya Da Shakran, she was the one who saved us and calmed her husband down. So that Berlin was a fabulous experience for the Rav, a difficult, ongoing tribulation, many challenges, but certain decisions were made by a mature individual that interact with him and color and give you and a certain meaning to the rest of his active career. We touched upon the most important, the scientific Jewish scholarship, because that topic and seeing Chaim today, it reminds me of Reb Meir Simcha, that I could just hear the Rav saying in Chav Meira that Professor Yaakov Katz had from mir begannt mein ein einziges Zum Chaim. And this is not meant in any way to be negative about Chaim, because his work is legendary. Whenever anyone will study Chachmat Yisrael today, who's a Talmud Chacham, they will show him the gold letter standard, Yayin Bimei Habanayim. Agudat Yisrael is part of the saga, but above all, the Rebbetzin Tanya Levitt. And finally, the Rav, how do I have the chutzpah to say this, these challenges, the Rav struggling? I mean, I could write an art scroll volume and say he went to Berlin, he got a doctorate, he was happy, never had a challenge, succeeded, never had second thoughts. But the Rav says it himself. If you're familiar with each halacha, right at the start, there's a Maimon Chazal he quotes. Do you know the Maimon Chazal? It's from the Sefer Sota, I believe, Daf Yud Zayin. He talks about Joseph HaTzadik. His name is Joseph HaTzadik in the Bible. That he came in that day to do malacha, and there's one opinion, he came in to sin with Potiphar. He came in to sin
with the woman who was trying to entice him. And what happened as he entered the house? In the window, he saw the Mutter Yukno, Shel Yaakov Avinu, of his father. He saw the image of his father. When he saw the image of his father, he came to his senses and he could no longer sin. That little introduction tells you that the Rav in Berlin faced many challenges. And what he describes as sin, I don't know if we can take it literally, but in his case, giving up risk and going into Chochmat Yisrael, later in life, he viewed it in a negative fashion, perhaps. And he says, the Mutter Yukno Shel Yaakov Avinu. Who was the Mutter Yukno for the Rav in Berlin? Reb Chaim Heller. That's exactly the way I would interpret it. And that's the gist of what the Rav says in his magnificent eulogy for Reb Chaim Heller. And all of us sitting here, we go further in life. I know in my case, I'll end off with one little story about the late lamented, and I don't make my peace with his death, David Applebaum, Hashem Yikom Damo, David and Nava. So when David came in Aliyah, every morning he went to learn with Rabbi Kustman. There was a yeshiva, Rabbi's Vilna, on Rehov Ramban, a yeshiva that was transferred from America, that originally was in Europe, and of course, Rav Gustman was a survivor. I believe his name was Rav Yitzchak Zeb Gustman, if I'm not mistaken. And Rav Gustman was a survivor. And the Rav went to study with him, Rav Gustman said shir every day, and had a group of talmidim around him, was a very well-known personality in America, then afterwards in Jerusalem. So I asked David, after learning with Rav Aaron Soloveitchik, what do you find in Rav Gustman that is so unique? And David said to me, Rav Aaron, I'll tell you what I find. When Rav Gustman says shir, on one side of him is Rav Chaim Moisey Brzezinski, and on the other side is Rav Shimon Shkab. And that's exactly the secret of our existence as Torah people. The Mutter Yukno and the Yaakov Avinu. And the greatest compliment anyone can pay me is that in my classroom, I do not sit alone in front of my talmidim. Thank you very, very much. I'll entertain you if you want to ask.
Innovation of Wissenschaftliche Judentum is a critical study of literary texts.
Right.
I mean, the Vilna Gaon already did that before.
Right, so you're saying, why did they oppose themselves to the Vilna Gaon? You want to know about it? I'll tell you a vod you won't forget. There was a graduation at Jewish Theological Seminary. So Professor Shaul Liebman got up, and he was the keynote speaker. I don't have to tell you who Professor Liebman was, and he was related to the Rebbe, you know, by marriage. He was married to Rebbe Meir Berlin's daughter. So Professor Liebman gets up. All of New York City was shaking, because we all heard about the talk. And he says, why does the world criticize me? I'm doing nothing different than the Vilna Gaon. And he solved the problem in the Vilna Gaon's life. You know, he never left Vilna. He never was Mevatel Torah. He left Vilna twice. Once when the Baal Tanya came in, he ran away from the city, not to be in the same city with the Baal Tanya. And the various, stories we hear today, the Rav also had a version that he ran away. Miracle had that if he would look at the Baal Tanya and his holiness, he'd become a chassid. So he ran away to avoid looking at him. All right. But earlier in life, the Rav wandered around Europe. And Professor Liebman said he wandered around Europe to go from library to library to find variant readings. What you say is very correct. I've said that too. What are we getting upset about? I'll tell you what the problem is. The problem is not so much in Talmud. The problem is in biblical criticism. Once you start with variant readings and manuscripts, where do you draw the line? What about the Bible? How do you tell them to stop? Where can you, where can't you? Well, the problem, then you go even further. You're dealing with the world. Remember, in our world, we have respect for Rabban. The Hasidic world certainly has respect. I know a chassid here in your community, a belza, with real feeling for bells. He will tell you stories. He gets a rebbe and a beta bracha, and he wants a bracha, and what it does for him. No, to a litvish mind, it's upsetting to hear it, but I have to tolerate it. Take that one step further now. Das Teira, you've heard of Das Teira? All right, Das Teira, whatever that means. But how do you apply that if you're going to have a critical scientific mind? So there are areas of tension. But I agree with you that Ribbono Shel Olam, the Bach, the shifted variant readings in the Gemara, the Masoret HaShas, the Vilna Gaon. So we do have a tradition, and we can justify looking for variant readings. I agree with you 100%. And in Israel, I think the whole Torah world agrees, because Mossad Rav Kush and Shalmi and Mossad Rav Herzog, all these institutions, Machon Yerushalayim, all these institutions that work on critical texts. So you're right, they've accepted Chochmah Yisrael is on that level. On the other levels, we desist.
Incidentally, on the Vilna Gaon traveling around looking for manuscripts, I don't know whether you